Me, I'm Phil Parr. It's hot in Texas today. Spring has come to the Lone Star State. I don't know what it's like where you are, but it's warm here. Probably 80 degrees, and that's hotter than I want it to be. Anyway, our guest is a gentleman by the name of Neil Ewers. Neil, how are you, sir? Welcome to Blind Like Me.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. It's about 65 degrees in Madison, and that's a whole lot better than 17 below, which it was a couple months ago.
In Madison, Wisconsin?
Yep.
Do you know Chris Zinchenko?
I know. Yes, I do.
You know,
I don't know him well, but I know him.
You know of him, huh? He's a good friend of ours, or he was a friend of ours that we've spent a little time with. One of the great things about spring coming to East Texas is we are past Olympus Week, which happened. Seems like there for about a two-week period, all any blind person was talking about was the Olympus recorder, which, of course, you are quite familiar with, since the podcast I read was, or the podcast I listened to was done by you. But we'll talk about that in a minute. What is your level of vision, sir?
I have light perception in one eye.
And that's about it.
That's about it.
And it doesn't do a fella a whole lot of good. I guess you can tell whether the light's on or off. But
Well, psychologically, it's nice, but I can tell whether the light's on or off. And otherwise, no, you're right.
But psychologically, I guess it would be some advantage if you, when you think about it, because you kind of feel like you got a little vision. Did you ever have vision?
No, I did not. But you bring up an interesting point, because I read an article a number of years ago in a medical journal about people who are blind going through, as do lots of other people, spring and fall discomforts as a result of light changes and calendar changes, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I certainly have that problem. I have trouble sleeping sometimes in the fall and sometimes in the spring. And the article went on to say that the only people who were not affected by this were people who had prosthetic eyes. In other words, even though there were a lot of blind people who could not see light, the light still registered in their eyes on their brain in a way that made their calendar work a little better than people who had two prosthetic eyes, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and so even though your eyes don't work some way, that light is perceived by your brain, and you know that the seasons are changing.
That's what this article was saying.
Well, I don't know. Is that a proven hard down science,
nope,
or is just?
Well, it was from the, I don't remember the,
yeah,
whatever that famous medical journal is. I can't remember. New England.
Mostly conjecture,
yeah,
on someone's part, you think?
Yep. Yep, you know, probably.
Well, I think a lot of us have trouble sleeping. I do. I get mine now that I don't work. It's almost impossible for me to keep nights and days straight. You know, I find myself up at 2 o'clock in the morning, wandering around, typing on the computer, eating bologna sandwiches, and I don't know. I'm too old to worry about it anymore.
No, I retired from the university a little over a year ago, and
yeah,
actually less structured, but I'm actually busier than I ever have been.
Yeah, you get
doing,
that.
Doing recordings, doing podcasts, doing all kinds of stuff.
But doing stuff that you really enjoy doing, stuff that maybe,
yep,
things that you've wanted to do for years. You were born blind, and what did they decide as a young Neil when they were going to send you to school? What was their thinking?
Well, my parents took me to a doctor, and what they couldn't figure out was, first of all, why I wasn't looking at things that was going on around me before,
yeah,
I was young enough to speak. Of course, this could have been all kinds of things. It could have been that I was blind. It could have been that I was deaf. It could have been that I was mentally impaired. So they didn't know what to think. I obviously wasn't talking yet, so they couldn't say, Neil, what's the problem? And after a bunch of tests, they discovered that my eyes didn't work. My optic nerve never developed, so they finally figured. But long before that, they... having doctors who didn't really know much about what they were doing, they said, well, let's put some glasses on him and see if that makes it work.
Yeah.
And, of course, I could see light. And so when my parents said, Neil, can you see? I said, of course. And so they thought, oh, maybe the glasses are working. But they ultimately realized that they weren't and that I could see. My dad would hold the flashlight in front of me, and I would know that it was on, and when he turned it off, I would know that it was off, but as they discovered, it didn't do me much good. What my dad did discover, however, was that as I was growing up and walking around and riding my bike around, there was a thing on TV, radio, I think it was actually on Oprah a number of months ago, about a guy who went around clicking his tongue and saying, oh, I can hear the echo off that. Well, I did that, and so did a lot of us many, many years ago.
Never
got on Oprah. But this guy sort of made out to believe that he was something special. Well, my dad would hear me click my tongue and snap my fingers, and he'd say, what are you doing, Neil? And I'd say, I'm listening to the house. And he'd say, okay, maybe he is mentally off-balanced. Actually, no, he didn't say that. But he finally realized that I was listening to the echo from the house, and I was using that to gauge how far away from the house I was.
Sure.
So long story short, my dad and I went through a bunch of just sort of tests that he figured out that I could do, and I finally realized that I could tell a lot of things about my environment by sound, and it's too bad that more of that isn't taught to people who are blind. I just happen to pick it up, so do a lot of people. And maybe now it's involved in the school curriculum more than it was, but I think that there could be a whole lot more done with it.
I've never heard anyone say, I was taught to use the echolocation system that we all totally blind people, you know, use. I did the same thing, rode a bike as a kid, but I could, and there was a tree in the middle of the sidewalk. I never hit the tree. I could hear it.
Yeah.
I went right around it and used a clicking of my tongue. Where now I'm old enough, my hearing's gone bad. I have to make a lot of noise now to hear the.
There was a time when people wore shoes that weren't crepe soles. I mean, my leather heel shoes, I actually wore heel metal plates on my shoes at one time, heel taps.
You could
hear miles away, and then they decided all that was bad for your back, and they thought, okay, let's go to rubber sole shoes. And it was actually like putting on a blindfold, because you really couldn't hear that much far away from you. Although you learn to, my hearing fortunately is still good, and I don't go around clicking my tongue, but my footsteps, the sound my clothing makes, the sound my voice makes if I'm talking to somebody, they all give off sounds that create echoes. And people are often amazed that they say, Neil, how do you know where you are in a room? I say, well, you know, because there's more echo over there than there is over there, and the ceiling's lower over here than it is over there, and there's a big sofa over there. I mean, you can learn to detect all kinds of things. But you're right. I have never heard anybody say that they were taught that.
No, at a blind school or any rehabilitation, but it is something that we all use, some better than others, but there are people, you know, I had a kid in school who was even better than me. This boy got around phenomenally, and he used the same system. He just did it better than I did. And so it took him a while to actually decide that you couldn't see.
Right. And then they realized I could, and they thought, okay, so what do we do? There was the school.
Yeah.
I grew up in Virginia. There was a school for the blind in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and that was back during the time when public schools were not able to handle people who were blind, as they do now, and so I was sent off at the age of almost five, not quite, to the school for the blind in Virginia, and spent my entire school life there. I've often wondered, if I had it to do over again, would I have done it differently? Would I have, on toward my later years, wanted to go to a public school? And I think I've decided that although the School for the Blind in Virginia didn't educate me academically as well as other schools might have, it was certainly better than the school I would have gone to had I stayed at home in Possum Hollow, Virginia, population 24.
Yeah.
And it had a bunch of teachers who, although they didn't give me a lot of academics, they gave me enough to get by. What they gave me was the realization that I was somebody. I don't know whether my principal planned this, or I just happened to walk in on a conversation that he was having with another teacher. But I remember one day, my junior year in high school, hearing my principal talking to another teacher and saying, you know, Neil's a real leader. And I thought, what? I never thought about myself as a leader. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that when we'd have discussions of things, people would invariably agree with me. Not that I was right all the time, and not that went to my head, but I realized that what these people were giving me was a self-confidence that I don't know if I would have gained or not in a regular school, especially in a rural school in Virginia. So, in a way, I guess I was lucky.
This is about the 160th hour we've done of exactly what you and I are doing, and of course we end up oftentimes discussing this very subject, public school versus school for the blind, because I've done people who've done both, who've done some school for the blind and some public school. That seems to be the best mix of getting, maybe, I talked to a girl this morning that did six grades of public school, and in the seventh grade, peer pressure became so great, the kids were avoiding her because she was blind, or don't play with her, or don't, you know, she's blind and we don't want anything to do with her, that she ended up going to a blind school, a school for the blind, not a blind school, but a school for the blind. So when I first started doing this, I was of the opinion that, yes, public school all the way, always public school. I'm not convinced of that anymore. I've changed after talking to lots of blind folks. I think maybe a mix of both, because after all, it is a sighted world, and you have to function in that sighted world, and it's up to you to adapt to the world.
Well, the nice thing that I had was that I had playmates when I went home, outside of the School for the Blind, who played games that weren't games I couldn't play. They weren't into football and baseball, and we rode our bikes. We did things that I could do without feeling that I was left out, and they treated me just like they did anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't grow up feeling myself inferior. I was never looked at least knowingly looked at. I'm sure lots of people thought, oh, look at the blind man, he doesn't know what he's doing. Of course, everybody does that. I mean,
sure,
not everybody, but I never got the psychological sense that I was being maligned or mistreated or whatever, either at the School for the Blind. And what's interesting is that back in the time that I went to school, and we don't necessarily need to make this a whole discussion of schools for the blind, but back when I was in school, these many millennia ago,
yeah,
schools for the blind were a lot different than they are now, because public schools can now deal with a lot of people who are partially sighted and people who are blind. Back then, in my rural area, they couldn't. So we had people who were not only blind, we had people who had pretty much normal vision, except they were nearsighted, so they couldn't see the blackboard at the front of the room. So they came to our school. So in essence, I grew up not in a school for the blind. I grew up in a school where there were people who were blind around, but there were also lots of people who could see, who'd say to me, Neil, you're not looking at me when you're talking to me. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, I guess I need to do that. Or you have a nice smile. So I didn't grow up in a sort of isolated world of people who were blind. I grew up in what could have been a normal public school situation with just an overabundance of people who were blind.
Yes, yeah, some of those kids who went to the blind school later on are driving cars, and you wonder, you know, what they're doing at the blind school and got a driver's license. But, yeah, you had some kids who, as you said, were just nearsighted or just had some.
Right.
And then you had the kid that came from the farm that was 12 years old and had never done any school at all,
yep.
that knew
yep.
nothing. And those
yeah,
poor
we had
kids.
Best.
Those
yeah,
poor kids,
best.
You know, bless their hearts. Those kids started out way behind.
Yep.
But Virginia School was a dormitory situation. It had all of the they wanted to tried very hard to keep the boys and girls segregated, I suppose.
Well, they didn't keep us segregated. It was a pretty normal social life. We had classes of boys and girls together. We probably played for the most part separately, but there were lots of them. I mean, we had socials and dances and proms and all that sort of stuff. It was a dormitory school.
We're talking about the 40s and 50s now, or what time
we're talking? I graduated. I'm going to give you some clues here.
You are.
About my ancientness. I graduated in 1962. So we're talking about 50s, late 40s, mid 50s, early 50s, mid 50s.
Yeah. So you were born about 43, 40, somewhere around there.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I was born in 40. I was what they called a pre-war baby. All right, so blind schools versus public schools, and you went through all 12 grades there at the Virginia School for the Blind, graduated. Do you think the guy knew you were listening when he said Neil is a leader? You think he knew that?
I don't know. What's interesting is that the principal of the school in Virginia was... Well, we had many of them when I was there, but the last one we had was Bill English, who is a very well-known leader among people who are dealing with this whole issue.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up coming to the School for the Blind in Wisconsin as principal, and so our paths crossed later in life, and I now know him. He will not tell me. He claims not to remember that. So I have no clue. My guess is that he knew I was around, but it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. It gave you the confidence.
It didn't give me, as I said, a big head. Okay, I'm a leader. So what does that mean? But it did make me. The other thing I think that affected me was that for the first number of years, up until I got to the fifth grade, I was really just unhappy in school. I was probably less mature than other kids my age, maybe. I don't know. But I came from a very rural background, and I had a teacher in the fifth grade who just scared the living, I don't know what, out of me.
Yeah.
And you knew you had to learn. You knew you had to do your homework, because if you didn't, she was going to get you somehow. And
somehow,
so
yeah.
I learned to do what I needed to do. And then in the sixth grade, I had a teacher who was one of the most wonderful teachers I ever had, who made me learn because I wanted to learn. But then I discovered the fifth grade teacher really sort of made me know how to learn. And now all of a sudden, my life is very different. I like school. I like what I was doing. So it was really, when I look back on my time in school, I think of it more as a personality education than an academic education.
Are you a Braille reader? Did they taught you Braille? Do you read Braille well?
They taught me Braille. 4 years ago, I had neck surgery, and one of the problems with the surgery was that I lost all the feeling in my Braille finger.
Oh, my.
I'm no longer a Braille reader. And what's interesting about that is that, of course, you know the Braille dot pattern, and you'd think, oh, I could read with anything. But it's interesting how much your mind really restricts what you learn to the actual part of your body that you learn to use it with. So even though I can feel the dots with my other fingers, I'm not nearly as fast a Braille reader. I actually, when I worked for the library or for the University of Wisconsin, and we'll get to that at some point, I really got into computers, mm-hmm. learned more than I thought I'd ever know about computers, and much prefer speech at this point, largely because I can't read Braille, and largely because Braille displays are too doggone expensive. And so you get used to reading pretty rapidly, and I guess I the last time I timed it, I read probably about 750 words a minute. I can read faster than my wife, actually, but of course she can look at the page and immediately get an overview of it, and I read one word at a time, or as good as well as the screen reader can do at letting me read parts of it. And that's I think one of the issues that people who are blind have, is that visual people are top-down learners. They can see things as a whole. You can look at a car engine, and you may not know anything about the engine, but you can see its parts. And I feel this part, and I feel that part, and I feel the other part, and I think, okay, what am I feeling here? And it's only because you put all those things together and remember where they are and form a mental picture that yeah. so you're learning from the bottom up. Whereas most people learn from the top down.
Because they can get the whole picture at once, where you're having to get little pieces of it and put it together.
Right. So my wife can look at the page and say, oh, down there's that bold heading that says whatever, and she can go down there and read it. And fortunately, screen readers have gotten good enough that they will allow you to do that too. But that's I'm sure we'll get there.
But they're there. The screen reader is there, and the speech is there, and so why not use it? You know, why not take advantage of that
exactly.
great speech? Okay, you graduated. When you graduated, what did you think you might be able to do to earn a buck or two?
Well, when I graduated, for a long time, I had the thoughts that I was going to become a minister. I grew up in a very religious household, and when I graduated from college or from high school, I went off to college, again in Lynchburg, at a small liberal arts college, which was very good in, tended to be really excellent in sociology, which is what I happened to major in, as well as I was going to major in religious studies. The longer I went, the more I got into sociology and the less I got into religion. And by the time I graduated, I had a degree in sociology and had sort of thought, I don't think I really want to be in the ministry.
Uh-huh.
But then what do you do with sociology besides teach it?
I don't know.
History and English and all those other things that, you know, I mean, they're nice. They give you a great background on how to understand people, which is what sociology did. But what do you do with it? And after going to college, I decided, well, I should probably go to graduate school, and because I if I stopped and get a job, and if I decide to go further my education, I probably would take me longer to sort of get back into it if I sort of dropped out and got a job. It took me a while to graduate from college, from high school to college, because academically, I don't think I was ready. My grades first semester in college, they were certainly passable, but every semester they got better because I learned that I couldn't keep up in Braille. That's when I started reading books on tape. And what was interesting about that is that I had lots of volunteer readers, and being from Virginia, they would read very slowly, you know, and I thought, I'm never going to read 200 pages at that pace. So I had my reel-to-reel recorder. I would sort of take it out of gear, put my finger in the take-up reel, and speed it up, I finally got to the point, as a lot of people did,
where you could do it legend. Yeah.
Right. But what's interesting is that you really had to totally change your mode of thinking from reading in a Braille fashion to reading auditorily. And when I first started doing that, I you listened to your recorder and you could hear everything that went on down the hall, and it really sort of interfered with your ability to. And so you had to learn to concentrate on just the listening of the book and rule out the people down the hall, which took a while, but I finally got there, as a lot of other people did. So I went through college by reading books on tape, went to graduate school, came to Wisconsin to go to graduate school. I applied to a number of schools and decided to come here to major in sociology because it was, again, a very good school in sociology. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, what am I going to do with that? I actually did teach for the university for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And then I decided I needed to get into something else. So I actually formed my own nonprofit. I formed two companies. One, a profit company, which is a recording company.
Okay.
Which I thought, okay, there are a lot of things that I know about sound, just as a result of being blind. How will that help me in recording? And so I got some recording equipment, and I would go record live concerts for people and make cassette copies for them. And my business began to grow quite rapidly because I did have a pretty good ear for where to place microphones and how to get really good sound. And so that sort of began to take off. And then I decided that I wanted to do something other than that, in addition to that. And I formed a company called InnerVision, which was a nonprofit company, which actually worked to help people who see with their eyes understand more about their non-visual senses. For example, I worked with a lot of counselors and with a lot of medical people, telephone operators, about things like, what does your voice really sound like to other people? I mean, you know, people like us who are blind, we listen to voices all the time, and we don't necessarily see somebody, but we have an impression about who they are based on their voice. It may or may not be an accurate impression, but it's an impression nonetheless. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, it's actually probably a more accurate impression than vision. Not that I'm dissing vision, but think about it for a second. How many times do people stand in front of the mirror and say, oh, I've got to straighten my tie, I've got to comb my hair, I've got to look good. But how many times do they practice what they're going to say every day? Not very many.
Okay, so you're moving, you're going way, you're too fast. I need to back you up a little bit. Let's back up to the recording.
Back up the tape.
Back up. I wish I could make that noise. Backing up the tape.
Yeah.
Your recording company. What did you? So many of us. You know, what did you record on? How did you do it? What made you think there was a market for this?
I knew there was a market for it because there were other people in town doing it. And
okay.
I thought, well, if they can do it, I can too.
Yep.
I sprang for a Nagra 4S recorder, which in the time that I recorded was the Cadillac of portable recorders. It's what the film industry used.
I know what a Nagra is.
Recording live sound. And I got to the point where I could set the headphone level a certain point and know that just based on trial and error whether a sound was too loud and was going to be distorted or whether it wasn't. And
okay.
Bought myself some microphones and a bunch of 6 or 8 tape decks, and mostly what I recorded was people's either recording sessions, for example, a choir that wanted to do a bunch of cassette copies, or somebody's recital, or somebody's live performance, and I would record it with my Nagra, which I would carry with me and put up my mics and then copy the tape onto cassettes and sell the cassettes.
Now,
and
was this mono? Were you doing this monaural?
No, this was stereo.
This was stereo.
Yep.
Okay, so you set
I basically had a really magic mic. I had a AKG 422 stereo microphone, which you could actually adjust in various kinds of ways. You could open up the two front capsules so that you could actually get a direct recording of the group. But if you wanted more echo, you could open up the back of the microphone a little at a time and gradually increase the echo without having to move the microphones back or forward or whatever.
Yeah.
So I got pretty good at doing that. And what's interesting is that that's basically what I recorded. I had a studio, but it was not a studio that I really could record a lot of music in, because I basically had an on location recording company that went out and recorded people where they were.
So you didn't have the big 24 track machine with the big mixer and all that. You had a stereo Nagra and some nice microphones and lots of cassette decks.
And my claim to fame for recording is that you aren't going to get 24 tracks. You aren't going to be able to adjust the violins versus the French horns. What you're going to get is what you'd hear if you were sitting on the third row of the auditorium.
Right.
And that was back at a time where a lot of the record industry, especially that did classical music, was putting microphones all over the place. So you basically got, as a final result, what the recording engineer wanted more than what the conductor wanted, because you could raise the sound of the brass section or the string section. I couldn't do that. I just had to be good enough to position my mics to where it all sounded good and sounded like it would sound like if you were sitting in your special second or third or fourth row, whatever seat in the auditorium, and I got pretty good at that.
Okay, then we have the company that teaches people about non-visual things. The thing that made you an expert at this, or made you even qualified to do this, was the fact that you were blind.
That is correct. In fact, probably the thing that made me the expert in both that and recording was the fact, not that people need to be blind to record, but I don't think I would have thought about recording if I hadn't been blind and hadn't been as interested in sound as I was. I actually got my first recorder when I was about 13 years old. It was a really cheap recorder, but I went around recording all kinds of stuff. And so I think in both respects it was the blindness, but especially in the second venture, because one of the things I happened on and have done ever since, even when I worked for the university, I've done workshops all over the place, not so much for public speaking, but for helping people understand what their voice says to other people when they use it. And it's like, you know, neither one of us know what each other looks like. Probably neither one of us cares. We probably have some feeling about the other person based on the same kinds of things that almost everybody uses when they hear a voice. But
oftentimes that's wrong. Message that you get, that you'd say, listen to, talk to this guy, and you think he looks like this, but oftentimes you don't have a clue as to what he looks like.
But I don't care. My point is, you're right. I'm not trying to teach people what you look like. I'm trying to teach people, okay, let's say you come across as somebody who is really not very confident. Maybe you're just a not very confident person, and if that's the case, you know, maybe I can't help you, maybe I can. But I can tell you things about how to change your voice, not to make it sound, I mean, not actually your voice, but for example, if I talk loudly all the time and people think I'm real pushy, I can correct that. I can change the volume level of my voice. If I talk in a monotone all the time and people think I'm really boring, I can change that. I can learn to put my voice on different pitches. So you can teach people a lot of things about how to use their voice in a way that reflects more who they are than who they just happen to come out by accident. For example, if you think about how you would say something like the sentence, I don't think I would ever do it that way. Now, I said that without much expression as just because I wanted to. But you could say that in a number of different ways. You could say, I don't think I'd ever do that, or I don't think I'd ever do that, or I don't think I'd ever do that. And they all mean different things. My point is that most people don't think about it as they say it. I have, in my business, I have followed at their request, people in business, people in whatever profession around with recorders, recorded them, they've listened back to themselves, and they've said, but I didn't mean to sound like that. Point is, they don't know how they sound. They haven't taken enough time to listen to it. And so that's, again, one of the things that I did as a result of being blind, is not that I'm the expert, but I spent, as a lot of people have, a lot of time thinking about things, and I know enough about the physics of voice, and I had to learn a lot about that, to know what it is a person can do to actually make themselves sound the way they want to sound, rather than what just comes out of their mouth when they don't think about it.
If you and I were in a room and six different women came through that room and stood and talked to us for a few minutes, and then they all left and we put down a score, do I find that woman sexy? Do I not find that woman sexy? I'd like to know what makes a blind person attracted to another person, because we have no visual cues whatsoever. It would have to be voice, or, you know, I'd like to do a study of that sort of thing.
No, actually, what's interesting about what you just said is that's precisely why I started this business, because when I was in the dorm first couple of years at the University of Wisconsin, I lived in one of the dorms, and it was right across from the cafeteria, and I happened to be in a room that overlooked the walk that went from the dorm to the cafeteria. Along about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, guys would gather in my room and we'd sit and talk, and I finally realized that one of the reasons they were gathering in my room is that they were there to look at all the women go across the bridge to the cafeteria, and they would say things like, wow, doesn't she have nice legs, or isn't that a great body? And I all of a sudden started thinking, wait a minute, you know? Oh, and they say things like, man, I'd really like to date her. And I'm thinking, you don't even know her. All you know is that she's got nice legs. I mean, is that a reason to date somebody? And so I started thinking, there's got to be more to a person than that. And so to answer your question, I think it depends on who you are and what you're after. It so happens, for whatever reason, that the people I have dated, and especially the woman I have married, have turned out to be physically very attractive, according to other people who know them. And I think what makes them physically attractive, among other things, is their smile, because that's one of the things I key in on, is does a person sound happy or bubbly, or, I mean, not giddy, but I'm not attracted to somebody who just sort of says, hi, how are you today? And so I think a lot of it is what, and I'm sure it differs for every listener who hears this. What is it that attracts you about a person? A lot of it's their voice. Interestingly enough, I suspect a lot of it is the smell. I once made a bet with some women I knew in graduate school when I was in the dorm that if they all went up to their rooms and put on different perfume, that I would be able to guess who they were based on their perfume. And they all laughed at me and said, oh, yeah, sure. And half of them said, well, I don't even wear perfume, but I have a bottle of this stuff that I wear every once in a while. So they actually did it. And to make it even harder, they took off their shoes when they walked by me so I wouldn't hear their footsteps. And I was 100% correct. I think not that, that could have been luck for all I know. But my point is that I think there are so many things we think about, whether it's perfume, whether it's voice, whether it's the way a person walks, the sound of their footsteps. My grandma used to say that she could tell the mood of my grandfather by the way he walked up the steps on his way home from work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can. So I don't think people just listen to voice. I think they listen to voice. I think they listen to footsteps. I think they listen to what's said. I think they listen to how it's said. I think they listen to how a person sounds when they walk. And if they're walking with them and they're holding onto their arm or the person's holding onto their arm, what's their touch like? There's just a whole lot of stuff.
And well, see, the great thing about what you just told is the wonderful thing about that is not only were you right, but you got to interact with a half a dozen women for an hour or so.
Well, of course, there are people who claim I'm not blind because I just like to walk close to a lot of women, but that's neither here nor there.
I love them all the same. We're at about 40 minutes. We've got 10 or 12 minutes here. You started these two businesses. This was out of college. You had a graduate degree at this time, sociology?
Right. Yep.
That you could teach with, but that's about it.
Let's make things quicker. I've left out a couple things.
Okay.
I've been a pianist for a number of years. I had all through school I was playing the piano, and when I graduated had a small chord with.
So you are a musical. You play
right.
Piano.
Right. And I now play keyboard and have a bunch of CDs out and that sort of thing, but that'll come later. What ultimately I did is the University of Wisconsin has something called the Trace Research and Development Center, which a lot of people have heard of because it's one of those things that's been around since the early 70s. It's responsible for a lot of the speech that's in computers. It's responsible for things like the Windows control panel accessibility options that we licensed to Microsoft. It was a place that was pretty internationally known for accessibility. And the guy who runs the place, Greg Vanderheiden, I had talked to off and on for a while. My wife and I moved to the Twin Cities for a while, and when we came back, he had always said, would you really think about coming and working for us? And I thought, yeah, nah. And finally, when we came back...
Wait a minute. And doing what for him? What did he want you to do?
He wanted me to be to become an expert in accessibility and work on developing speech synthesis, work on developing access to Windows, access to mainstream products, etc., by people who were blind. And ultimately, he convinced me that I should do that. So I worked for Trace for about 13 years. And when I started, our focus was more on, okay, why doesn't this screen reader work very well with Windows 3.1 or DOS or whatever? And what can we tell the Microsoft or the screen reader that would make it work better? And little by little, computers became a part of almost everything. They're in your microwave, they're in your cell phone, they're in your, whatever, recorders now. So what basically we did for the last 4 or 5 years that I was there was to try to get major companies to develop products not just for people who were blind, like, $4,000 or $2,000 Palm Pilots that only work for people who are blind.
Yeah.
But what about developing a cell phone with speech in it, which Verizon was one of the first to do, that actually would work for people who were blind? But hey, you know what? There are people who aren't blind who wouldn't mind that either. If I'm driving down the road at night and I'm trying to dial the phone, maybe I want to hear what it's saying rather than looking off the road. And so we made some real inroads into getting people in industry to think about making their products accessible. We did a lot of work in voting and what worked for electronic voting. We actually did some prototypes of voting technology, and we weren't in the market to sell them as much as we were in the market to say, okay, here's what we've tried, here's what we found worked, here's what doesn't work. It ain't going to cost that much. You can do it. You can make it accessible not only to people who are blind, but people who are mobility impaired, people who have low vision, people who have dyslexia. So why don't you do it? And I think we were pretty successful, have been pretty successful in getting people to do that. So I spent the last...
How did this fellow make money? I mean, how did he earn? Was this a grant, a nonprofit?
Federal grants.
Federal grants.
Federal grants. You paid for it.
Oh, okay. But this isn't, he didn't end up with manufacturing a screen reader or anything like that? Or
no, basically our intent was not to manufacture, but it was to come up with research that suggested what could be done if people wanted to manufacture something. And so we have reams of website material and reams of papers about what we've tried and what works and what doesn't work, so that people don't have to recreate the wheel.
Yeah.
And they don't necessarily have to do things the way we did it, but we make what we have discovered available to industry, to the public, and they can do with it what they wish.
Now, what years did all this take place when you worked for this?
I started working at Trace in 1992, and I retired last year.
Oh, so you said for the university, and so that was your final.
That's the part. Yes.
That was your last job. That is what you did up until last year.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, you dropped the recording, the mobile recording thing?
Oh, no. I still do that.
That's what I heard.
I still do that. I still compose and produce my own music. I have a Kurzweil keyboard, and I have all the sounds of digital instruments, and so I have a number of CDs out on the market. I discovered that although playing the piano was nice, having harps and flutes and violins and choirs and whatever are even better, because now you have a whole orchestra.
Well, but you didn't have that when you first started playing those 88 keys.
That's right.
You just had
to. I do now, though, which is kind of nice. So I have not only stuff that I do, I still do on-location recording. I do a lot of nature recording. I love getting out in nature and recording, and I have a bunch of nature CDs available. So I think that's my excuse to get out in the woods and just be in nature and just go recording. And I've come up with some of my own and some other people's techniques of recording nature sounds that I think sound pretty realistic. So again, it's a puzzle. It's what do I hear and how do I make it sound exactly like what I hear when you listen to the recording.
Of course, now with digital, it's much easier to do that.
It's much easier to make the recording. It isn't necessarily easy. You know, a lot of people think they can just put up a microphone and record, and it'll sound exactly like what it does when they're there, and it ain't so. There is a lot that can be learned in terms of microphone techniques and whatever, and that's a lot of what I've been sharing in my retirement and learning more about from others. But you're right. It is no longer the case that I record on my Nagra 4S for an hour and a half and then have to go copy it, which takes another 2.5 hours or 4.5.
Yeah.
I can dump it directly into my computer and, hey, look, it's there. So in that regard, and the other thing that's easier is that I can do a lot of processing on it. For example, if I had something 8 or 10 years ago and I wanted to raise the volume of the track, what do? You copy it over at a higher level, and it takes 1.5 hours to do it because it's 1.5-hour program.
And you lose. You lose something.
Right.
You do that, tape.
Now you just run it through SoundForge or whatever studio editor you're
whatever
using.
Whatever you like. Goldwave. All right. What do you record on these days besides our wonderful Olympus?
Well, I have, I think, the other end of the spectrum. Because I run a recording company, I have what's comparable to the Nagra 4S, which is a Sound Devices manufacturer 744T recorder, which is a four-track recorder, which is about the size of a paperback book. It has a slot for a 4-gigabyte flash card. It also has a 40-gigabyte hard drive. It has the quietest mic preamps in the world, and I have some of the best mics in the world. So because of the work I do, I've gone to the other end. But I also as a lot of people who hear me know, do a lot of podcasts on lesser expensive stuff because I really enjoy helping people learn about the technology that's out there. I've done lots of reviews on the Olympus, the Zoom recorder, the MicroTrack recorder, the Eddyroll recorder. So partly to learn about it myself, but partly to help people know, okay, you're not all going to need to afford what I use because you don't all own recording companies. But if you want to do a podcast or you just want to record your family or some nature sounds, what is it that you use?
And that Olympus will do you just fine for those sorts of things.
Well, it has its limitations.
Yes, it does.
But it's you know, for what it's meant to do, which is a dictating recorder, it certainly does a fair amount more than that. It's not gonna be a total broadcast quality recording, but you can do pretty doggone well.
It has talking menus. Now you say that you have this recorder that you have, and then you have the world's best mics. Do you have a Neumann mic or
several? I have Neumanns, I have Sheps, I have Brühl and Kerr, I have AKG, I have Rode. Neumann and Sheps probably are Neumann and Sheps and B&K are probably the single most widely used mics in terms of classical music recording, and that's what I do mostly of. I mean, if you're doing a drum and a jazz quartet, those may not be the mics you use. But if you're recording an orchestra or a choir or nature sounds, that's what most people who would do professional recording would probably be using, or at least that kind of microphone.
Okay.
Not that particular brand, but that ilk of microphone.
You're familiar with the AKG 414, the studio standard mic that every studio has 8 or 10 of them.
I have one.
Okay, I'm sure you do. Would there be that mic? You can buy those mics for $600, $700, $800 on eBay. You can buy them now.
Yes. And what's interesting is that they're 20-year-old microphones, and they're still going for that. No, they're older than that. And they're still going for that much. They're good
now,
mics.
What would a Neumann mic cost that you would approve? What is the Neumann cost that you have? $5,000? $10,000?
The Neumann, well, the Sheps I have and the Neumanns I have are about the same price. Sheps are a little more. You can get mics. In fact, both my Sheps and my Neumanns have interchangeable capsules. You get a microphone, preamp, and you can screw one omnidirectional capsule off and put a cardioid capsule on or a figure eight capsule on or whatever.
Yeah.
You can spend $5,000 on getting a set of microphones with all their attendant attachments.
Okay, so we have a $1,000 mic and a $5,000 mic. Is the $5,000 mic five times better than the $1,000 mic?
In that it's more flexible, yes. In terms of sound, not necessarily, because there's some very inexpensive mics now on the market coming out of places like Korea and China, and the Chinese have really sort of stolen, in a lot of people's opinions, our technology and made it a whole lot less expensively. I have, for example, a Neumann TLM-103, which is about an $800 microphone.
Okay.
There are a couple microphones that I could mention which sound, you'd have to really notice, you'd have to really listen closely to hear any difference at all, and they're maybe $100.
Mention them. So, tell me what you're talking about. Studio Projects, Mike. You know what I'm talking about?
That's one.
Studio Projects is one.
Behringer is another. Behringer makes some very good quality mics. Rode makes some the Rode NT1A is probably $180, $200. Sounds just as good as my Neumann TLM-103. Which sells for four times that much.
I'm using a Studio Projects mic to do vocals now, and I find I EQ it less than lots of mics I've used.
Well, mics all have different acoustic properties. Yeah. Some have more proximity effects, some have more bass, some have bass roll-off switches, some don't. So they're going to be different, but the overall sound of some of the less expensive mics is just as good and just as quiet. In fact, the Rode NT1A mic is about as quiet as any mic on the planet. They all have their electronic noise built in. It's sort of like tape hiss if you turn it up loud enough.
Sure.
And the Rode, for its price, is quieter than the Neumann, sounds just as good. So there you go. The people are making a lot better mics for a lot cheaper price these days. But if you want the flexibility of being able to unattach part of your mic, and
you'll have to buy another part, then
you got to buy something different.
All right, we've killed 55 minutes, which is all the time we have. Do you have a general coverage email address in case someone wants to talk with you, or do you have a website or something you can give?
I have both. You can reach me via email at neal@ewers@ravenswood, which is the name of my company, R-A-V as in Victor, E-N as in Nancy, S-W-O-O-D, ravenswood.org. And my website is ravenswood.org.
Neal, I've done 5 interviews today. You were the last, and you ended the day on a wonderful note. I've enjoyed very much talking with you, and I'll be in touch and let you know when we're going to air this.
All right. Good to talk to you.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Well, what a guy.
What a guy, huh? Neal Ewers, if you want to hear some of the things he's done, some of the various podcasts he's done about things, there are several of them at Blind Cool Tech, all one word, Blind Cool Tech. You'll find several things that Neal Ewers has done, plus a lot of other really nifty things. So go up there and look around and let us know what you think. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, be sure and email me, phil@philparr.net, or you can call me, Phil Parr. My phone number here is 936-634-9500. phil@philparr.net or philparr@consolidated.net. Either one will work. 936-634-9500. We always need guests, and come tell your life story and be a part of this thing. It's very painless. Some folks even think it's fun. All right. Thank you much, and we'll see you next time on Blind Like Me. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.